Good morning. As I was watching Fox News last night, Shepard Smith was reporting from a place called Long Beach, Mississippi. How many of you ever heard of it? Long Beach, Mississippi. I used to live there. I lived there for about 7 months or so when I was doing construction work down in South Louisiana at a NASA base down there. And I lived there right, in fact, Highway 90, which you hear so much about in the news, my driveway, the driveway of the house or apartment, whatever you want to call it, was actually a house made into the upstairs portion was rented, and so was the lower portion. It's where I lived. The driveway went right out to Highway 90, and you could look out the window, the front window, or from the front lawn, and you could look and you could see the Gulf out there. And we would frequently walk across the road, and just there you were on the beach right away. It was my understanding that, and I don't remember the story very well because it was back in the early 80s when I lived there. It's my understanding that the lady who owned the place, she was quite elderly at that point, but she had lived through Camille, and I think substantial damage had been done to that house, and it was repaired, and she had some reinforcements done so that in the event of another disaster like Camille. Well, I think, I haven't been down there, of course, but I think Katrina probably wiped that one out, just as Katrina wiped many other homes out in that same area. So it's my old home place. Hadn't seen it since the mid-90s, one day when we were, one time when we were visiting New Orleans, to visit the New Orleans church. We had a CGI congregation there, and we rode over with Tom and Audrey Carey. We went for a Sunday afternoon drive while we were there, and went over and looked at the old home place, I guess you could call it. I'm sure it's not there anymore. I'm quite certain that it was destroyed. And that I, you know, of course, in spite of the efforts that were made to reinforce some of those homes due to what happened in the hurricane back in 69. I think Camille was in 1969, wasn't it? 1969. In spite of that, so many of those homes were demolished anyway. In fact, when I was there in South Mississippi back in those years, and that's the area near Gulfport and Biloxi, the whole, you know, the strip down through there, past Christiane. We learned it was past Christiane, not past Christian. When you get there and you start calling it past Christian, they will quickly correct you. It's past Christiane, and even though it's spelled like Christian. But in any case, I recall very well some friends that we met down there, some church members who lived right there nearby where we were living. Showed us around, showed us some of the disaster, the things that Camille had done over a decade earlier. And I remember showing the foundation, what was left of what was supposed to be a hurricane-proof house that someone had built, and it destroyed it completely. So these things can be very, very devastating, these natural disasters, as we call them. Not long ago, the tsunami was the big news. Almost daily, we heard the reports about the rising death toll and all the devastation, the destruction done by the tsunami. Of course, there have been many tsunamis. Hawaii has been struck by tsunamis time and time again. Japan, many tsunamis there. And probably some of us didn't know what a tsunami was until the recent one. We used to call them tidal waves back in the old days, but they're not really tidal waves. There have been objections to the use of that expression because the normal ebb and flow of the tide, what causes the tide, is not the same thing that causes a tsunami. It's not really a part of the tidal, the natural tidal action of the ocean. It's something else quite, something very different. In fact, well, I'll just read this. This is something I took from the PBS.org website. You may have seen or heard similar statements on documentaries produced by PBS. From the Savage Earth section, it says volcanic eruptions can cause tsunamis. It explains the causes of tsunamis. It says that volcanic eruptions often cause, or sometimes they can cause them. And it goes on to say, in fact, the most deadly tsunami in recorded history followed the eruption and virtual obliteration of Indonesia's Krakatoa volcano in 1883. An estimated 36,000 people died as a result of the eruption, the majority of them from the tsunamis that resulted. What happens in a tsunami is that a massive amount of water in the ocean is suddenly displaced. Now, what do you get when you throw a little rock into a puddle? Everybody's done that. You displace water. When the rock hits the water, you displace it, and you see the ripples go across the water. And if you have something floating in the water, you see what it does, or something right on the edge of the water, little objects on the edge of the water, it just knocks them right down. Or you've all seen that. Well, that's essentially the same principle in a tsunami, only most tsunamis result from earthquakes underneath the ocean floor. And when you have the shifting of those plates, and you have the sudden shifting of the land or the ocean floor, like a major segment of it or a major section of it drops down suddenly as a result of the shifting of the plates underneath, then what you have is a massive disruption of water, an enormous amount of water. And this sends, of course, the ripples, you might say, across the ocean. And, you know, oftentimes, many times people have been out at sea. You might think, boy, I would hate to be out there on a cruise or something, or out on a boat way out at sea when a tsunami comes along. But, you know, there have been fishermen to go out and didn't notice a thing, had a good day of fishing, come back to the harbor late that day and see that it's just utterly devastated. Everything was destroyed. So what happened here? Everything seemed calm out there. You see, what happens deep down on the ocean floor, we're talking about very, very great depths. This is where the earthquake takes place, where the shifting takes place, and all that massive displacement of water takes place. So you have all this activity going on down there, and then meanwhile up at the surface, as the ripple goes out, all you get is what is here. If you notice it at all, if you're out there, usually it's just like kind of a hump in the water, you might say. You know, just a hump comes along, you ride it and think nothing of it. Now what happens is that thing moves, you know, not knowing what just passed underneath you, what kind of power just passed underneath. What happens as the distance between the ocean floor and the surface becomes narrower and narrower? Well, that hump in the water, if you want to call it that, rises higher and higher, as it were. So by the time it gets to the land, the area where, you know, water meets land, you have a huge wave coming in, and it oftentimes destroys whatever is in its path. So we have this, and it's a natural phenomenon. Also, another quotation from the same source says, scientists at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico calculated that if an asteroid 3 miles across hit the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, now there are bigger ones than that, but if one 3 miles, a big one, 3 miles across, hit the Atlantic Ocean, the tsunami would swamp the upper east coast as far inland as the Appalachian Mountains and drown the coasts of France and Portugal. So there is a potential for some really massive destruction and huge, incredibly huge, massive losses of life as a result of an incident like that. Now, I'd like to read something from an article here. This came from the Los Angeles Times. I found it by way of the Internet. But this was written on September 8th. And it says, the U.S. Geological Survey seismologist Lucy Jones remembers attending an emergency training session in August 2001. Now, keep that date in mind. August, remember September 2001. In August 2001, with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, that discussed the three most likely catastrophes to strike the United States. What do you suppose they were? Well, let's hear what this group said they most likely would be. First on the list was a terrorist attack in New York. Second was a super-strength hurricane hitting New Orleans. Third was a major earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. Two out of three so far. I don't know, you know, supposedly this is an accurate source. I would rather it not be, but supposedly it is. And they seem to know based on their studies what things are most likely to strike the United States. And it looks like that there is a very real danger with earthquakes. So we could talk about all kinds of natural disasters. We could talk about tsunamis. We could talk about earthquakes, hurricanes, typhoons. It's my understanding that typhoon is simply a hurricane that spins in the opposite direction. Tornadoes, we know what damage they can do. Those who've lived, obviously, who've lived in Tornado Alley or in parts of the country where tornadoes are very common, have seen the damage that can be done there. Massive flooding due to the forces of nature, and all of these are classified natural disasters, and they're commonly called acts of God. According to the dictionary and the insurance companies, an act of God is an event caused by the operations of nature, not by human actions or negligence. So it's classified act of God. When something like a tsunami occurs, a hurricane, a tornado, bad things happen from some kind of natural disaster, this is called commonly an act of God. You hear it in the media all the time. And it's part of our language. Well, it was an act of God. But was it really an act of God, this recent Hurricane Katrina? Was that really an act of God, or all these other things I've mentioned? You know, a lot of people insist that it was. I'd like to read from another article here that came, of course, from the Internet. You can get just about anything you want on the Internet. Some things pretty good, some things not so good. Let me see if I can get these pages in order. Okay. The article starts out, this is from WorldNet Daily, and September 7th, starts off, Jerusalem. While most religious authorities seem to agree one cannot discern the intentions of God, there has been talk in some circles here and on the Internet, the storm that turned parts of the Gulf Coast into a disaster zone, prompting hundreds of thousands to evacuate their homes and possibly causing upwards of 10,000 deaths. Hopefully that number is not accurate now that the latest is that it's much lower than that, thankfully, was thrust upon the United States for what? So you can get this off the Internet and get it out of the chat rooms. Its support of the Gaza evacuation. Now, I want you to listen to some of this reasoning here. It goes on to talk about that some more, and then it gives several point-by-point reasons. And these are supposedly eerie parallels. It says here in the subhead, eerie parallels between forced evacuations and, of course, well, in Gaza and in the United States, in the New Orleans area. It says, close to 10,000 Jews were expelled from their homes in the Gaza Strip and parts of northern Samaria. Katrina's death toll is now expected to reach at least 10,000. Well, it was expected, no more, apparently. But that's supposed to be somehow God is trying to send a message. I don't like it when you make my people move out of the land, you know, the Gaza Strip there. Another point here that's made, there's several of them, I'll just read a few of them. It says, Gaza's Jewish communities were located in Israel's southeastern coastal region. America's southeastern coastal region now lies in ruins. So-called eerie parallels here. Another point, the U.S. government called on Louisiana residents to evacuate their homes ahead of the storm. The Israeli government, backed by statements from U.S. officials, demanded Gaza residents evacuate their homes. You see, this whole thing is based on the promise given to Abraham, I will bless you, bless them who bless you, and so on. And if we're not a blessing to Abraham, to his descendants, then God will not bless us. And so apparently the Bush administration's support of the evacuation from Gaza has brought this terrible and deadly hurricane to our shores. Another point here, Katrina, written in Hebrew. Now this one is a really, really important one. Pay careful attention. Written in Hebrew has a numerical equivalent of 374, according to a biblical numbering system upheld by all traditional Jewish authorities. Boy, I want to find out about that secret Hebrew biblical numbering system. It says two relevant passages in the Torah share the exact numerical equivalent. It's in Genesis 50 and verse 17, which says, they have done you evil. And also in Exodus 14 and verse 15, the sea upon land. Okay. You know, you could probably go through the scriptures and find all kinds of statements and phrases that have the numerical equivalent of 374 according to this secret biblical numbering system that only, I guess, the elect few know about. Now then, get this one. This is really interesting. Bush from Texas and Rice, Condoleezza Rice, from Alabama, were the most vocal U.S. backers of the Gaza evacuation. Hurricane Katrina hit, guess where? You got Texas, you got Alabama. What lies between Texas and Alabama? Louisiana and Mississippi. Wow. Is this an amazing parallel or what? And it goes on. There's several other similar comments like that. And it goes on to say, in a Jerusalem Newswire op-ed discussing the similarities just before Katrina made landfall, writer Stan Goodenough commented, "Is this some sort of bizarre coincidence? Not for those who believe in the God of the Bible and the immutability of His Word. What America is about to experience is the lifting of God's hand of protection, the implementation of His judgment on the nation most responsible for endangering the land and people of Israel." Well, that explanation may be good enough for Mr. Goodenough, but it's not quite good enough for me, and I think probably it's not for you either. Anyway, on and on it goes like that. Many ideas. Some of you may have heard also that the storm that struck the Gulf Coast was due to, and particularly the devastation that was done in New Orleans was due to the upcoming or then upcoming Decadence Festival. Did you hear about that one? You know, I was down in New Orleans a good many years back. I think it may be the mid-90s, and down there for a church visit. And usually on a Saturday night, we would go out with some of the church people, Tom and Audrey Carey and some of the others. And it's an enjoyable place, a fun place to be if you have some people who live there and know the place, know where to stay away from and the things to visit. And also people who know the history of the place. It's culturally rich. And a lot of historical sites there, very interesting. And I've always enjoyed seeing those things. And also there's some very well-known restaurants in the area. Some of them serve things that you wouldn't eat, that none of us would eat, I don't think. But some people do eat. But in any case, there's some restaurants there, very well-known. And we always had a fun time. But we were down there one time on a Labor Day weekend, and I think it was a Saturday night, and we were, you know, if you've ever been there on Bourbon Street, people are just walking up and down, the policemen are on horses and so on, and you see everything. You see people carrying signs, "Repent, the end is near," and signs condemning alcoholism and homosexuality and all that. On the other hand, you see the alcoholics and the homosexuals. So all kinds of things go on down there. I was down there one time for the St. Patrick's Day Parade. At least I witnessed part of it. And all these public officials were marching down this little narrow street with all these floats. And they were throwing the beads, you know, as they always do down there. The green ones, of course, for St. Patrick. Everybody was wearing green. And people literally who were in the parade were staggering down the street as drunk as could possibly be. And I'm looking, and I don't recognize all the public officials, but here comes one guy. I said, "I can't believe it. It's David Duke." He was there. People started, you know, cheering him. He starts throwing kisses and all that. But there he was walking down the street in the midst of all this, in this parade with all this drunkenness and everything else going on. But back to the Labor Day weekend. We kept noticing that these guys, these obviously gay people, were all over the place that night. And one of the ladies, well, I know some of them were cross-dressers, you know, they're dressed up, men dressed up like women. Some of them were the, I don't know what kind of outfits you call them, but the leather things that look the straps and all that. They remind you, have you seen any of these old gladiator movies of the kinds of things the gladiators wore? Well, one of the ladies that was with us said that those look like, and she was trying to say gladiators, so those look like gladiolas. I think she was pretty close to it. And she didn't really know what was going on there. But we did know, Tom Carey and I had talked about it. I said, "Boy, he was asking, well, where's all this? Normally it's not like this. What in the world is going on? He seemed like he was a little bit embarrassed about it. You know, it's just, he actually lives over in Gretna, not right there in New Orleans, but not in the heart of the city. But these guys were all over the place. And then we found out the next day, or the day thereafter, that that was the yearly Decadence Festival. That's literally what they call it, the Decadence Festival, where people would come in from all over, you know, deranged, sodomites and everything else, would come in from all over the place, and they would have this big festival. Well, Katrina struck just before time for the festival. And naturally, some people said, ah, that's why. God wanted to put a stop to it. Well, if that's the case, you wonder why he didn't. I won't mention any other places for the sake of the tape program, those who might be offended if I mention their cities. But, you know, other places in the country are worse. And I don't want those people on the West Coast anything happen to them. But, no, in any case, this kind of thing has been going on for a long time, and New Orleans is probably not the worst of places. But anyway, some people think that God sent Katrina into that area because of the upcoming Decadence Festival. Well, guess what happens? They have it anyway. I don't know if you saw some of the pictures in the paper or on the news where, in spite of the fact that in other parts of the city there were floating dead bodies and all kinds of chaos going on, here these guys were marching or parading down Bourbon Street, all these perverts. It's just amazing. In one way, that's even worse. They had the regular Decadence Festival, you know, that's bad enough. But knowing that here they are parading as if to be proud of their perversity, and in another part of the other parts of the city, there's all this chaos going on and dead bodies floating around. So it happened anyway, and it seems that the hurricane didn't stop it. Well, again, you can ask the question, are these things really acts of God? And my position is that when I look around, look at reality, things like this have gone on for centuries. We see more of them in our lifetime because we have television. We have reports coming in from all over the world, and we can see these things happening. We know that a lot of things like that, from tsunamis to earthquakes to all other kinds of natural disasters, have taken place and are taking place and no doubt will take place. But I'd like to go to Genesis chapter 18 and take a look at a principle here. Genesis chapter 18, I think most of you know the story, but we'll go ahead and summarize it. We'll start in chapter 18, verse 16. And this is the account where Abraham had three very special visitors. It turns out that one is obviously God, the other two were angels, were messengers who went on into Sodom after they visited with Abraham for a while. And we'll take up the account there in verse 16. It says, then the men, that's the two angels, rose from there and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on the way. And the Lord, this would be the third man, or the one who, you know, obviously is God in a manifest form, and the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, and the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. So he's saying, am I going to hide from the one I have chosen, the one who will teach his children the way of the Lord, the one through whom all the blessings will be ultimately blessed? Will I hide this from him? And the Lord said, because the outcry, it goes on to tell, he's now going to reveal to Abraham what he's going to do. Because the outcry, verse 20, against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come up to me, and if so, I will know. Some say this is anthropomorphic, that God already knew in reality, but he's communicating with Abraham, and of course you understand the limitation here is not with God, it's with Abraham. Then the men, that's the other two, described in chapter 19 and verse 1 as angels, turned away from there and went toward Sodom. But Abraham still stood before the Lord. And Abraham came near and said, "Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked?" That's the question I believe I would ask if I had the guts to ask it. I'm not so sure I would have, I would be able to do that. I mean, if this was God standing before me in this form that he took, I don't know that I would be able to ask that, but that would certainly be a question on my mind. Are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Careful there, Abraham. Careful, you know who you're talking to. Of course, he is obviously taking care here. So the Lord said, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes." If I find 50, only 50, I will spare the place for their sakes. Then Abraham answered and said, "Indeed now, I who am but dust and ashes have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord." He's being very careful as to how he continues this line of reasoning here. He says, "Suppose there were less 5 than the 50 righteous, would you destroy all the city for lack of 5? So he said, "If I find 45 there, I will not destroy it." And he spoke to him yet again and said, "Suppose that you should find 40. And you know the story comes on down to 30, 20. And finally, he says, then he said, "Let not the Lord be angry," verse 32, "and I will speak but once more. Suppose 10 should be found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Now you're going over to chapter 19. It describes Sodom's depravity there, the account of the two angels and Lot, and Lot's house, and the men of Sodom. And then we see that the angels, the two angels commanded, they led Lot out of the city. There was some resistance there. It seems to have been anyway, some reluctance or a little bit of delay, but they finally did go out. You know the story of Lot's wife, how she looked back and so on. That's another story for another time. But I want to get to the main point here, and that's in verse 24. It says, "Then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. So he overthrew those cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities that grew on the ground." So the question is, did God find 10 righteous in the city? Well, apparently not. Apparently not. He did call for an evacuation here, as you see, and Lot and his wife and daughters were taken out of the city. They left. They settled in another city in the same region, a city that was not destroyed. But the others were. Sodom and Gomorrah, apparently other settlements in the plain, were destroyed because of their iniquity, because of their sinfulness. It had reached a certain level. Evidently, when the sinfulness of a people, whether a city, a nation, whatever, reaches a certain level, then God does take action, or at least, you know, it's in his prerogative to do so. We see scriptural examples of him doing so, and he did so here. Were there 50 righteous people in New Orleans or on the Gulf Coast? Before I go further, let me pause to explain something, because this gets into a theological issue here. Some would say, no, there were very few righteous people down there. If you define righteousness as those who have the Spirit of God, those who are begotten of the Holy Spirit, as we say. But now you see, the Bible speaks of righteousness in different ways. The Apostle Paul addresses that when he speaks of ethical righteousness. He calls it righteousness of the law. Not a bad thing. Not a bad thing at all. It's a good thing. It's just that that's not the righteousness that regenerates you. It's not the righteousness that saves you. Ethical righteousness, that's just being good. Okay? And you find goodness, being good, defined in the Ten Commandments, in the law of God in general. Loving God, loving your fellow man, you know, refraining from murder, theft, adultery, all those bad things. That's ethical righteousness. Being good to your neighbor. You see a lot of ethical righteousness going on right now in the response to the hurricane, and people are getting together and doing what they can, the outpouring of love to those people who were affected by the hurricane. That's ethical righteousness. It is a part of ethical righteousness. The righteousness of God, which is a righteousness that comes by way of faith, is regenerative righteousness. We've talked about that in the past. I don't want to get too deeply into it here. There's a taped message entitled Righteousness. It talks about the difference between the righteousness of God or righteousness unto salvation and ethical righteousness. So my question, were there 50 ethically righteous people along the Gulf Coast? And the answer is there were and are thousands. There are thousands of ethically righteous people, good people, people willing to help other people, people who make good neighbors, people who would, as the old saying goes, give the shirt off their back to help you out of a bad situation. So there were thousands. So it would seem to me that the hurricane, Hurricane Katrina, was not an act of God in reality. It was not. But, you know, there are some questions that come out of this, and I don't have the answers here for you today. I can't help but wonder about them. I think back about how God promised Abraham, the account we just read, how he promised him he would not destroy Sodom if he could find 10 righteous in the city. My question, I can't help but think this way, and again, I don't have the answers. I don't fully understand it. I could come up with some possibilities I could throw out there. But are we to suppose that there were no small children and little babies in Sodom and Gomorrah? And I think there are probably more than 10 out of them, too. So evidently, there's a difference between righteousness and innocence. And I guess we could reason our way through this, and possibly we could. Of course, the very idea that there is a day of salvation for these, that makes a big difference, of course. But rather than the idea that they're all sent to hell and they're suffering in hell right now because they never had a chance for salvation, that's totally a different subject. But that does make a difference when you realize there is a chance for salvation for these people. Well, one could argue that the children of Sodom would have been corrupted by their society had that society been allowed to continue. So they were evidently wiped out right along with the city. Same as the flood. You know, Noah found grace in the eyes of God. Are we to assume that Noah alone was righteous? Noah and perhaps his family? Or maybe the family got the benefits because Noah's righteousness. Are we to assume that he alone was righteous? Well, it seems so from the account, but then are we to assume that there were no little babies and innocent little children alive at the time that the flood took place? I would think that there must have been a good many of them. You could argue, you could reason the same way, however, that had they grown up, they would have grown up in a corrupt society and would have been corrupted by that society. And, of course, we know that there will be an opportunity for salvation along the way. It's not as if that was it for those people who were destroyed in the flood, those innocent children who were destroyed in the flood. But I don't have all the answers when it comes to theodicy. Why God allows things to be. I don't have all the answers. We see through a glass darkly, and we just have to trust in God that everything will turn out right for us in the end, and all we can do is speculate about some of these, some of the things, you know, the reasons God has for some of these things. In any case, I do not believe for a moment that the natural disasters we have seen in our lifetimes are truly acts of God. But having said that, I do want to point out that God does judge the nations, and sometimes the righteous within those nations are adversely affected by those judgments. Turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 16. Let's read about some very interesting characters here, some personalities. 1 Kings chapter 16. And we'll take up the account here in verse 29. It says, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab the son of Omri became king over Israel. And Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. Samaria being the northern part, that's where the kingdom of Israel settled, the kingdom of Judah to the south. Now Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. So, to put it in the vernacular, this was one bad dude here. He was wicked. He did more. This is chapter 16, 1 Kings chapter 16, that's verse 29. So, Ahab was the worst of the kings up to this point, the kings of Israel. He goes on, and it came to pass, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he took as wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. And he went and served Baal and worshipped him. You know, he just treated this as a trivial thing. He just, no big deal, I'm going to go worship Baal. Then he set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. Like a trivial thing to him. And Ahab made a wooden image. And it's the margin here tells me that this is from the Hebrew Asherah, which is a Canaanite goddess. Evidently an image to a goddess, a Canaanite goddess, said Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. So what does God frequently do when a king comes along that stirs his wrath because of the abominations such as idolatry and the things that Ahab was doing? What does he do? He normally sends prophets, doesn't he? Well, he'd send a lot of prophets, but there's one special one that he sends here who accomplished very much. His name was Elijah. Chapter 17 and verse 1. And Elijah the Tishbite of the inhabitants of Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord God of Israel lives before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years except at my word." There shall not be rain these years. It turns out to be 3+ years, except at my word. In other words, as soon as I say it, when I give the word, then rain will start again. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "Get away from here and turn eastward and hide by the brook Cherith, Kirith, which flows into the Jordan. And it will be that you shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there." So he went and did according to the word of the Lord, and he went and stayed by the brook Kirith, which flows into the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And it happened after a while that the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. And it goes on to tell the story of Elijah, the things that were done. It talks about in the next section here, it talks about Elijah and the widow. He stayed at a widow's home. It talks about the miracle that was performed there, how that the bin of flour and the jar of oil did not run out. It was a small amount, evidently, but never ran low, never ran out the whole time Elijah was there. Talks about the woman's son becoming sick and evidently dying, or at least having the appearance of death, and Elijah praying over him, and he's revived. And the woman knew that Elijah was a man of God from this. And then it goes on in chapter 18 to talk about Elijah's meeting with Ahab. And let's skip over a lot of this. It tells about Elijah first ran across Obadiah, told Obadiah to go back to Ahab and tell him that he was going to come to him. And Obadiah was a little bit concerned about this because he figured if he brought a message like that back to Ahab, that Ahab would kill him. But he did. He went on back and told him this. And let's take up the account there. It's in chapter 18 and verse 17. "Then it happened when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said to him, 'Is that you, O troubler of Israel?'" You see, Ahab saw things from a different perspective. He sees Elijah, and he knows Elijah. He sees Elijah as the one who stopped the rain. He's the one who caused the drought. Elijah was not the problem. Elijah had the cure, as it were, the remedy, the solution to the problem. Ahab and his sinfulness, his idolatry, his worship of false gods, all of those things, that was the problem. And Ahab says, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" Interesting how the wicked tend to turn things around, isn't it? "And he answered, 'I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, and that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and have followed the Baals. Now, therefore, send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. And you know the story here. They do go to Mount Carmel. They attempt to offer, they're going to offer their sacrifice on the altar and ask their gods, the Baals, or Baal, the chief of the gods, to consume the sacrifice on the altar. And so they dance around and evidently have a good old time, cut themselves a little bit here and there, and nothing ever happens. And Elijah starts to taunt them about it a little bit. And then they put Elijah's offering on the altar. They soak it down with water. There still was a drought going on, but they still had access to water. There's areas round about that had water that they could bring in from the outside. But they soak it down good with water. You know, things soaked with water don't burn very well. And so he has this one short prayer to let the people know that his God is God. The fire falls and consumes the sacrifice and laps the whole thing up. And, of course, the prophets of Baal are slain. But that didn't end the evil rule. It didn't end the wickedness of Jezebel or of Ahab. And so Elijah finds himself having to escape from Jezebel. She seeks his life. And he runs away. He makes a 40-day trip across an area to a mountain. And then God finds him there. Let's take up that account in chapter... let's read about that, chapter 19. And let's see. Verse 9. And there he went into the cave and spent the night in that place. And behold, this is talking about Elijah. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" So he said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." And then drop on down to verse 14. Again, the same thing says, and he said, "I have..." This is, again, God said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Verse 14, and he said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." Then the Lord said to him, "Go, return your way to the wilderness of Damascus." He gives him some instructions here, but here's what I want to focus on in verse 18. This is God's reply. You know, Elijah was feeling all alone. He said, "Look what they've done. They've killed your prophets," as he said here, "destroyed your altars. They're worshiping Baal and Asherah, the false gods, and I alone remain." And he thinks that, you know, of course he knew Obadiah had been there. He knew the prophets Obadiah had hidden in a cave, were somewhere. Of course, they were being fed and given water and so on. But he knew also that Jezebel was killing every prophet she could find, trying to eliminate the worship of Yahweh from the land and replace it with the worship of the Baals. He says in verse 18, God says, "Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal." You say, Elijah, you're not alone. Don't think you're alone. It appears that way. "I have reserved 7,000 in Israel whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." They didn't go around kissing the images of Baal. In other words, there were 7,000 who feared God. There were 7,000 righteous in Israel. But you know, the interesting thing about this is that in spite of the fact that there were 7,000 righteous there, God still sent the drought. Of course, the drought was ended at a certain point here. We skipped over that point. Back in chapter 18, the drought came to an end at Elijah's word. And with his evidently, it doesn't say in the text that Elijah prayed, but it's evident that he did. It said he bowed his face down, so he obviously prayed, and God brought an end to the drought. The rain came. But while this drought was on, there were the righteous who undoubtedly suffered or were afflicted because of the drought. The righteous with the unrighteous. So I can only conclude from this that from time to time, sometimes God does allow the righteous to endure the judgments that He pours out. Even though I don't believe that Katrina and all these other disasters that we've talked about were sent by God, certainly God judges nations, and sometimes He does allow the righteous to suffer certain things. But by the same token, it also must be understood that He sometimes delivers the righteous out of harm's way. And I think we see that going on in Revelation chapter 6. Certainly we see the righteous suffering a great deal during the reign of the beast. In Revelation chapter 6, however, we see something else beginning to happen. First of all, you see the seals being stripped away from the scroll. And each seal represents certain events or certain things, and John sees and describes these things that pertain to the end of the age and everything that leads up to it. The first seal, the second, third, and fourth seals, we understand those represent the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as they're called. The fifth seal represents a time of martyrdom during a time of great tribulation. And then finally, it comes to the sixth seal. We see this as cosmic disturbances. Cosmic disturbances are described here. And these are all the same things that Christ talked about in the Olivet Prophecy. But something interesting happens here in chapter 7. It says, after these things, this is once the sixth seal is open, and now then they're awaiting the seventh seal. We understand the seventh seal represents the day of the Lord, which is the day of God's wrath. That's when His judgments are poured out. Now, there's tribulation prior to this in the world. Bad things are happening. But now God's judgments are going to be poured out on this earth, on the nations. But it says something happens here before then. It says, after these things I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And then he goes on to talk about the number of those sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. Then he sees a great multitude. There are different ways of interpreting this section. I'm not going to get into that at this point. But it says over in verse 4, once the seventh seal is opened and the plagues are poured out, I want you to notice what it says in verse 4, chapter 9. It says, they were commanded. This was the locust that came up out of the bottomless pit. Obviously, a lot of symbolism here. They were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads, indicating that those who do have the seal of God are those being protected during this particular time of God's wrath. And this is in the day of the Lord, which is just prior to and leading up to the second coming of Christ, as we understand biblical prophecy here. So the point is that we do see that sometimes God or God's people have to endure the judgments that God pours out into the earth, but sometimes He delivers the righteous out of harm's way. It depends on the circumstances. It depends, I think, on the nature of the judgment that's being poured out. One more scripture I'd like to go to before closing, and that's in Luke chapter 21, something Jesus said, I think, in relation to the heavenly signs that we see here described in Revelation. In Luke chapter 21, we usually go to Matthew 24 and maybe skip over some of the things that Mark and Luke say in their accounts of the Olivet Prophecy. But I think this is very interesting. He talks about the same things, the abomination of desolation, destruction of Jerusalem, and so on, in answering the question, what shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? And then he says in verse 25, Luke 21, verse 25, and there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. I think a lot of people can relate to that at this point, can't they? I wonder what it'll be like in that day, though, at the very end. If this is just a portent, if this is something we see, some things we see in this world from many, from going way back all the way down to our time, these things happening, what must it be like in the very time prior to the coming of Christ? It says, men's hearts failing them for fear and expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. It says, now, when these things, what things? The things he just mentioned here. When these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. So there will come a time when we'll see more of the things we've already seen with greater intensity. But remember the words of Jesus, when you see these things, then look up. Then know that your redemption draws near. So there's hope for a better world in the future.